Okay. Failing Writers Podcast new episode, take 12. Let's try not to mess this one up, boys. Okay.
Right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Failing Writers Podcast. We've got to get on with it because there's a lot to pack in this one and it's very interesting.
It is very interesting.
It is.
Very interesting. Yeah. Not us, we're not interesting.
No.
Yet again, it's a guest that's provided the interest.
Yep.
We're just the vehicle for the interesting people to be interested.
Yes. So we have author of the scintillating That Night. It's Gillian McAllister.
We're talking to Gillian McAllister about how you banish the demons who cause malice in the palace of your mind. She's telling us how to be a bit more studious, how not to get whiny and moody if Richard and Judy don't come knocking every time.
We are thrilled and honoured to welcome onto the Failing Writers Podcast the Sunday Times best-selling author, and more importantly, perhaps, an author with a Richard and Judy Book Club seal of approval. It's Gillian McAllister. Hello, Gillian.
Hi.
Or do you prefer Gilly during informal chats?
I do go as Gilly, yeah. I write as
all right.
Gillian, but yeah, I do sort of go by Gilly.
All right,
Gilly.
We'll call you Gilly if that's all right.
Welcome, Gilly.
Do you ever get fed up, Gilly, of people introducing you with the various Sunday Times best-selling and... that you've got a Richard and Judy ticket.
Not really. I mean, would you? Like?
Yeah, that would be quite nice.
It's always a rush.
Yeah. I'd be so happy with it if it was me, to be fair.
Yeah.
I think I'd make my mum and dad refer to me as best-selling. Like, you know, just any conversation.
Would you like a cup of tea, best-selling Dave Bears?
Yeah,
that kind of thing.
We do have a bit of a joke in our house. If anybody ever says the title of one of my books, which is quite easy to say that night, I do make them preface it, you know, with the Sunday Times number 8 bestseller or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Why not?
And is it true you got a Richard and Judy Book Club sticker tattoo on your forehead, or is that...
I'm considering where
that's
to get
work
it,
in progress.
Yeah.
That might be actually.
Yeah. Did you do a little dance around the room when you found out that your latest book had been picked to be featured on the Richard and Judy Book Club experience?
Yeah, I definitely did. I knew I was longlisted, actually, and they then pick the selection from the long list. So I didn't really know the odds and the timescale. But it's like a life-changing kind of moment, even if it's like an accolade, isn't it? As much as anything else.
Yeah.
And then I had to keep it secret for months.
Oh, God.
So I was a very smug person for months, and nobody really knew why, I think.
So where were you when you found it? You just got a call from your agent or something? Or was
it was an email from my editor.
Right.
And I was literally just got back from walking my dog, and I was just standing in my kitchen, and I just stood there in shock.
You just did that, I'm going to read this email 4 times, and it still does. Is this real?
Yeah, it doesn't really feel real. Yeah, it is strange. It is strange. And it's all quite, I suppose a lot of things in publishing, that they're theoretical for ages, and then you kind of... they become real months later. And by then you're sort of used to the news. So it is quite strange. Often it is just an email, but you kind of know your life will change in some way.
So do you see the impact of that straight away in terms of sort of sales or publicity? Once you are a Richard and Judy author, is it sort of like an instant change?
Yeah, so... I mean, it was announced on its publication day that it was in the summer book club, and the sales have been higher, and it is, I mean, without wanting to brag, it's currently number 1 on the Kindle store, so it has had a massive
impact. Brag away, why
go
not?
Yeah.
Brag away, I mean, I've never got near that with my past books, so, it has had a big impact.
So what is it? Is this your 6th or 7th book?
Yeah, it's my 6th book, So... it's kind of nice to know things can still happen kind of later in your career. Really.
Yeah, so how did you get, you sort of zoom back to the first book? Was that something you'd been writing for a long time? Because I know with a lot of authors, that first book has kind of been brewing for years, hasn't it? Was that the case with you?
The one that was published, actually, not really. And that's of why I mean, it took me a really, really long time to get published and many books, which I always think it's kind of worth reminding people, because it can kind of look like overnight success. And so I wrote a book in 2014 and got a couple of full requests but didn't get signed, and then wrote a book in 2015 and did get signed, and it had 2 submissions, the second one we did a kind of a revise and resubmit because most publishers that rejected it had the same problem with it, so we took out that problem.
Oh, that's quite good.
Yeah.
It's quite handy, that, isn't it?
Well, you'd think. And then did the revise and resubmit, did the second round, everybody rejected it.
Oh.
And then wrote another one called What Jack Did. And then the day before it went on submission, we retitled it Everything But the Truth. And that is the one that got the two-bit deal with Penguin.
Yeah.
But I only ever had one offer from Penguin. And I mean, it and all of my books was a Sunday Times bestseller. But, you know, it didn't have a massive advance. It had one offer. I had been rejected on three different submission occasions. So, you know, I'm very well acquainted with failure, really, I think.
Well, yeah, join the club there. So I was reading that you studied and worked as a solicitor to begin with. So were you writing all the time whilst you were doing other things? Was it like a long-standing dream?
Yeah, it definitely was. I actually was off sick when I wrote my first book, the one before the one that got me an agent, before the one that got me a publisher.
Right.
I had a sort of immune problem, which I now know to be lupus, but I didn't know then. So I was just off. And it was almost like I was tired, but I was able to kind of right from a bed.
Yeah.
So I wrote then, and it was almost a little bit like a plan B because nobody really knew what was wrong with me. And law is quite physically demanding on the body because the hours are long and there's a lot of presenteeism.
Yeah.
So it was kind of, I mean, I'd always had a blog and I'd always kind of started novels, but that was the first time that I actually kind of saw one through to the end and finished one. And then because I got some full requests from agents, I then, even though I was back at work and healthy, I felt I ought to carry on with the fiction, really, because it was what I'd always wanted to do. And I finally had this sort of agent interest.
Yeah.
And it was quite a difficult few years because I ultimately wrote a second book and then that did get an agent. And then I wrote a third book with that agent. And all the while I was working full time. I worked for an American law firm, which was quite long hours and like high targets. So that was really stressful and not what somebody should be doing when kind of convalescing either, I would say.
No, I imagine not.
So I basically didn't do anything else. Like, I didn't really have a social life. I just sat at laptops. And yeah, I went part-time pretty much as soon as I could and then quit the year after.
So like, yeah, what was that like when you sort of felt confident enough to kind of give up the day job?
Yeah, it was quite a weird moment actually, because we wanted to kind of move to the country, which we now have, and we viewed a house that we only would have been able to buy if I was earning what I was from books and what I was in law. And something about having to put my money where my mouth was, I sat in the car after we viewed this house and I said to my boyfriend, what if I only had one job though? Like, and he was like, well, we can't afford this. And it was kind of a moment where I thought, yeah, I don't actually want to run both horses forever. Like, I actually just want to be a full-time writer. And I was lucky enough that my advances upped because my first book was a bestseller and my second one sustained it. And so financially I could quit, but it took me a long time because it's kind of a vocation, law, and I trained for a really long time and I had a really good relationship with my boss as well, and I didn't really want to feel like I'd been kind of taking them for a ride. But yeah, basically just walked in one day and quit, which was fairly satisfying.
Yeah, absolutely.
So lads, Jilly was working in law and writing the rest of the time.
Yeah.
Does that make you feel bad?
Well, you mean the fact that we...
Why didn't we write more when we actually had the time to write?
The fact that we have...
Instead of going out drinking.
We have quite easy jobs and yet still don't find the time to write around it. I suppose, yes, I guess so, John. Thanks for bringing that up.
it makes me feel quite guilty.
If it helps, I kind of fuck around all day now. So.
Well, you've earned the right.
That does make me feel a bit better.
Yeah.
What's your writing structure like now then, Jilly?
It's chaotic, I would say. When I'm writing a first draft, I write 1,000 words and then I'm allowed my lunch, and 1,000 words and then I'm allowed my dinner. And that is because if you give me enough rope, I'll hang myself. So I have to have a structure, otherwise I'll do nothing. That is what I do. And then when I'm editing, I sort of change it to a scene in the morning, a scene in the afternoon. So yeah, but it is hard working for yourself. Like, I'm a night owl by nature, and that is really difficult because I'm constantly in a battle to not get up late. Like, stay up late, get up late is what I actually want to do. And yeah. It's not very normal to get up at 11 o'clock when you're in your late 30s. So, like, I'm constantly in a battle to do that, constantly in a battle with screen time and procrastination.
I think that's a brilliant idea, though. Doing 1,000 words before you can eat, that would definitely work with me.
Yeah, and I've always been quite militant about it because I know myself and I know that I was trying to write a novel for a decade and not actually producing much. And when I got that first agent request, I was like, okay, how am I actually going to do this? And I decided then, because I had a full-time job, I would write 1,000 words a day. And I just made myself do it, even like Christmas Day. I still did it. And I did produce a book in 6 months. And yeah, I think for some people, I think that's the only way. Like, other people can kind of moderate themselves, but I actually can't really. I need a structure from above, like I'm at school.
Those people are weird though, aren't they, Jilly? Yeah. Let's face it. Those people are weird.
They really are. Like, I know. Like, my boyfriend can just read his phone and then put it down and then read a book in bed. And if I have my phone within a metre of me, I'll be on the internet all night. Yeah. Like, I'm just not. I'm not made of the same stuff.
No, it's difficult. That does sound like a very good system, though, because I want to write more, but I also want to lose some weight. So it's kind of win-win, isn't it? If I can't eat anything until you've done 1,000 words.
It is win-win. Either you'll write lots and eat lots, or you'll write nothing, but you will lose weight.
What I love is that nothing's off limits. I mean, there's no... I can eat any food I want.
I've already dropped 2 dress sizes and a shoe size, somehow.
People just can't believe the results of the new FW diet plan. Simply sign up to our plan, then swear a blood oath on the souls of your children that you won't eat a single bite until you've written 1,000 words.
I signed up and the weight's just dropped off us. I mean... literally, that I haven't eaten anything in weeks. I'm starving. Please, just a little sandwich or a bowl of gravy.
No, not until you've written something.
But I haven't got any ideas, man.
The Failing Writer's Diet Plan. Hello, writer's block. Bye-bye, muffin top.
I feel like I might write those 1,000 words very quickly and very badly, though, just to get to the food. That's the only downside.
Well, that's okay. Like, I'm a big fan of a trash draft.
Well, yeah,
as they
that's
say.
True. Are you a bit of a plotter, or are you kind of full pants to the wind, or how do you work?
No, I am a plotter, definitely. But I am 7 for 7 on deleting my first draft. So I've done it for 7 books. And then I start again. So that's
a full
really
delete, an actual full delete.
Like, I obviously don't like, you know, I'm not a masochist. The file is somewhere. Like, I don't like burn my laptop. But
So you just use that as a background reference in your head?
Yeah, pretty much.
I kind of did this in the past, but I've got rid of it.
Yeah, it's kind of like, now I know what the book is about.
Yeah,
actually,
now
by
I know
the end
the
of the
characters.
First draft, I normally have a revelation that, oh, it's actually about this. And then I can write from a kind of running start, a second draft that then stays. So I do plan, but I mean, quite why? I don't know, because clearly it doesn't work.
To be fair though, does that take quite a lot of pressure off that first draft though as well?
I think,
It just helps you just think, well, I'm just going to write it because I'm going to put it in the bin anyway. This is just kind of...
I mean, I think worryingly, I always think I won't, like, so...
It's been 7 times now, Julie. I think we can...
I know.
Establish that this is a system you have now.
Yeah, it really is.
Oh my God, just imagine the first time if you don't know. You'll be like,
I know. I think I'm quite superstitious.
Hold on
now.
A minute.
I think I almost have to.
That'll really confuse you.
Yeah, I know. It would spook me, actually. That book would be the failure, I think, if it hadn't been deleted.
is there always a, you know, now you're very, very successful and you've got a good load of books behind you. How do you feel about the next book? Because being an author, there's that thing, isn't there? You're only as good as your last book. I know you've kind of got the back catalogue, if you like, but the agent's going to give you that. Ring you up or email and go, so what's the next one then?
Yeah, I think I'm less afraid of the process because I know now that it's really normal at 40,000 words to hate the book and to feel like nothing happens. And like,
it's easy, isn't it? Just
quit.
Shit out the draft and delete it. I mean, that's...
Well,
that's
exactly. I mean,
I've got you
low
now.
Stakes, yeah. So I think I'm more, like, I'm better with, like, the fact that the process is full of self-doubt and that's just normal and I can kind of see that for what it is.
That's a great way of looking at it, so
but I definitely get the heebie-jeebies about ideas. I'd like to have like the next 10 books like ideas lined up.
Yeah.
Because it's a big phobia of mine that I just won't have one. And they're so like, they don't come from anywhere. Like, there's no process for having one. You just have them or not.
So the idea is just kind of for the next book, does it, it just kind of appears at the right time?
It does vary, actually. I had only really just started the one that's just come out when I had a huge idea for the next, and I found it completely distracting.
Right.
And now, so that was really early, and then I finally wrote that, and I had a really good time writing it, and I didn't have any idea when I submitted that book to my publisher, and I did go off in a bit of a frenzy, like... You know, like, I don't know if you watch Alan Partridge, but when he's, like, dictating stupid ideas, that was me, like, monkey tennis and, like...
Monkey tennis.
So, but actually, yeah, they
Youth hustling with Chris Eubank.
Yeah, exactly. That was me. But, yeah, they do come. And weirdly, I started off with a... I wanted to write a siege situation, but I couldn't work out how to do it originally. And then I sort of thought about like a siege by analogy where somebody is threatened to do something on jewellery service. And then actually I'm not doing that. I'm doing something that's a step on from that. But it was kind of interesting to see the process of like, I was thinking about hostage situations. And then suddenly I was like, what if a jewellery member gets told you must make the jewellery convict this person? And then I liked that. But then I was like, jewellery is a bit talky and a bit boring. So I'm now doing something like a little bit further on from that. But it was interesting to kind of be like, I watched it kind of organically arrive. Whereas some, like my previous book, which is like a time loop kind of Groundhog Day book, that just came out of nowhere. But that book was like the golden child. I don't know. It was the dream. So I think it's hard to follow up those books sometimes.
It sounds like a really interesting book. That can you tell us a tiny? I know it's not out yet, but it sounds like a really interesting sort of moral dilemma book with a fantastical element to it.
Yes, a little bit. I mean, it is very much a crime novel. But so it's called Wrong Place, Wrong Time. Mm. It's out in hardback next spring. And it's about a woman called Jen who is waiting up for her 18-year-old son, Todd, the night the clocks go back and he's late. And he appears outside the house and he has a knife and he stabs a stranger, like he commits an act of knife crime. And the next day, Jen wakes up, you know, intent on figuring out Todd's, you know, in prison, like in police custody, and she's going to get him a lawyer and everything. She goes into his bedroom and he's in there and he doesn't have any recollection of the night before. And then the next day she wakes up and it's the day before. So basically she travels backwards each day, a day before the murder. And she's trying to get to the inception of why he does it. It's kind of about like organized crime and gangs and stuff. So it's my baby, that book. I did still delete the first draft, but it was it was a relatively easy book other than that.
That sounds like it's got option for film and TV all over that one.
I hope so. Although it does have a twist in the middle, which I can't really say why, but it makes it really hard to option. I've kind of shot myself in the foot there.
Are any of your books being considered at the moment for TV?
Yeah, there is one with an option and another one had an option that lapsed, but honestly, like, if you think publishing is slow, like like literally nothing will happen for like 4 years and then you get an email like, we've got a writer or we've got an actor attached. Like, it is mad. I used to really obsess over it and then now I'm like, I forget about it and then occasionally get news and think, yeah, well, something might happen.
Speaking of obsessing, do you read your bad reviews as well as your good?
Yeah, I do. I pretty much read all the literature on myself late at night.
That sounds healthy.
Oh, yeah, really healthy behaviour. I do think there probably is a... I think it's good to read your reviews because sometimes there is a consensus that really teaches me something. You know, if 100 people who don't have a vendetta or anything say, I really liked this book, but nothing really happened until halfway. Like, I think it's my job to take that on board, actually. If your ego can stand it, which, you know, it should. Cause...
You can kind of spot the weird reviews, can't you? Because they stand a mile out, because they are weird.
Yeah, you know, people that really hate it or moan about it took 5 days to come through Amazon, whatever. Yeah. Like, I'm not interested in that.
Yeah,
but, the 3 stars, I think, are... people that didn't love it but didn't hate it. I think that's really interesting to kind of look at those learn from them.
So do you think you have a fairly, it sounds like you have a fairly powerful internal critic then. do those doubts ever get like too much, or do you feel like you can always overcome them? I mean, I suppose 6-7 books in, you're kind of you can silence them quite easily.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, you're right, I am my biggest critic, but my process really would be write something, criticise it, write again, pick holes in it, you know, patch up the holes, and then think it's good, because it's kind of like nobody's more critical than me. But it can't, it's perfectionism, really, and I think that can be a helpful thing if you can harness it. Like, I just think, okay, something in my gut's telling me the ending isn't working, so I kind of need to listen to that. So I don't think it's like self-doubt as such. I think it's like a very critical reader, which I am. Like, I am a picky reader.
I think that gives you strength, though, doesn't it, in the end? Because you do think, well, if my internal critic has been through it and as we've got through that, then actually it'll be okay. Do you know what I mean? There's only so much that can be wrong with it now, because I've deleted the first draft and picked it to pieces.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, I think it was Taylor Swift who said when
the great,
she released
that great philosopher.
Exactly. Yeah, it was either her or it was Plato. Yeah. When she released those two albums in lockdown, somebody was like, "Why are you so prolific?" Basically, and she said, "I know how to write a good pop song," and I just thought it was kind of a really empowering thing to say, because actually most readers actually can spot what's wrong in a novel. Yeah. So we all actually have that kind of power. It's just harnessing it and kind of being able to come up with a solution, I think.
So come on then, Gillian, can you share with us the secret to the bestseller? What's the magic formula, and how can
I
we...
I thought you were going to ask her to sing some Taylor Swift then.
I was thinking, oh my God, what's...
How can we emulate the bestseller? Because we need to write one now.
I think a premise is very important to publishers. So I'm just looking at... I've been wondering why That Night has been particularly successful. And I think it's because you can sum it up in a line.
Right.
Like, my protagonist gets a phone call from her sister to say, "I've killed a man and I need you to help me cover it up." And it's immediately, my protagonist is flung into that decision. And that happens in chapter one, which I think getting to that hook is helpful. But I do think there's a lot of things that come in, like timing comes into it, luck most definitely comes into it. But I think if you write novels that you can sum up in a line and you work hard on them and you edit them, I think a lot of people could get published if they did that. Yeah. And I think most people that don't either don't do that or they give up. Like, I could have given up after two submissions and I didn't know that I was going to sell on the third.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, we did an episode about log lines. I think that's really true. I think if you can't condense it into that simple phrase, then you're going to struggle to sell it. It is a very good premise.
Yeah, and most books hit the bestseller list in their first week. So this is not people reading them and going, "I loved this, I'm going to make my friend read it." This is retailers deciding how much power and placement to give it. So you need your publisher to love the book, but word of mouth kind of comes later, really. You need those people that just see it, and they haven't seen it anywhere, they haven't been recommended it, they just want to pick it up. And that is, I mean, when I pick a book up, I go on title, cover and premise. Yeah.
But there's on the cover of That Night, there's a quote from, I think it's your podcast partner, Holly.
That's right.
Crowned you the queen of the moral dilemma. Do you think it's important to have that sort of style, that instantly recognisable style to grow a sort of loyal readership? And to sort of agents and publishers want that? So they can consistently sell a particular style.
I think it's good. It's always good to have a USP, but I think it can, like, if you're not doing what anybody else is doing, that can also be difficult. Like, I think you would, if you wanted to write a thriller, I think it's perfectly okay to write, you know, thrillers that anybody would recognise as a thriller. They're solidly in the genre, but you do them well, or you do something slightly different. So, yeah, I don't really think anybody kind of needs to invent a genre. And, like, so many novels contain moral dilemmas. like almost all thrillers actually do. I think I've just been kind of, mine are sort of quite overt, I guess. Yeah. Like they're often the hook.
Yeah, they zoom in on that.
Yeah, but I think, no, I don't really think it's, I think if you wrote a good thriller, publishers would buy it.
Yeah. Mm.
So do that, Dave.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's what I'll do. If only I'd thought of that earlier. But it's great because I've been reading That Night, and it has got a lot of those sort of moments where I feel I have to sort of stop reading it and think to myself, what would I do in that situation? And you start to reveal a bit of yourself, don't you? And do you find that when you're writing things like this, that you suddenly realise things about yourself that you hadn't before? Like, you know, like, I mean, what would you do if you had to bury a body? Do you sort of suddenly reveal some darker elements of yourself?
Yeah, I think it's quite, I sometimes treat it quite mechanically. Like in That Night, I sort of invented that the perpetrator has a young child to push it to a situation where they are more likely to not ring the police. And they had a previous sort of half altercation with the police earlier in the day that puts them on the back foot a bit.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't know. I think the guilt would kill me to bury a body. Like, it would just be, I'd just dig it back up again to, like, end the misery, I think.
Well, yeah, I think the same thing, but then...
Worst criminal ever.
Yeah.
Another part of me starts thinking, oh, no, they shouldn't have done that. No, if they really want to get away with it, what they want to do is, you know, just carry
on. There is a lot of... Poor old Kathy, she's getting a lot of stick on Amazon for not doing exactly the right things. But, yeah, I suppose I do
it
like
funny,
to...
funny, though, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Readers are sometimes quite pious, yeah.
How people... How these... It's almost like, no, your characters should make exactly the right decision all the time.
Yeah, and like they make the decision.
That's not what people do.
At like 1 o'clock in the morning. Like
under severe stress, you're going to make the wrong, you're going to do something stupid.
Rationally, yeah. Yeah, I do think some readers do have a bit of a lack of sympathy there. But
it'd also be a really short book, wouldn't it?
Well, it would, yeah, quite. I mean, stupid decisions make plot, really.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do like to kind of, I don't know. I don't know if other thriller writers like to do this or not, but I do like to sort of pose provocative questions of the reader, really, and kind of, I don't know, I think it's nice in a book to, if you can relate it to yourself and you come away thinking, I'm not sure if I would have acted like that, but I kind of want to discuss it with someone, so I'm going to recommend it anyway. Like, I think that's kind of where word of mouth might kick in if you really relate.
Yeah. I think you're going to get a deeper connection with the reader.
Yeah, that's it.
You've got more of a buy into it, haven't you, psychologically?
Yeah, like one of my protagonists in one of my earlier books shoots a burglar, and that really got a lot of people talking, and I was kind of looking at the discussions, and I mean, that's quite a divisive topic anyway.
Not really, just shoot him.
Crikey.
Am I wrong?
Well, that's everything you need to know about Tom.
Good to know.
Just know, before you go into Tom's house, make sure he's absolutely invited you in before you set foot in there. Just to be on the safe side, get it in writing.
Don't just let yourself in.
No.
Do you have siblings?
Yes,
Jilly?
I do have a sister. I have not buried a body for her.
No. That's what I was wondering. She doesn't live next door or anything.
No, she doesn't live next door. I know. I do feel quite sorry for my sister, because it must be quite weird when your sister writes a book about burying a body for your sister and it's suddenly everywhere. She must feel like, thanks very much. Yeah.
Do you get people suspecting that they are a character in your book? Have you ever had anyone saying that was me?
Yeah, and to which I would say all authors exhaust all of that in their debut. So if you're really interested, you can read my debut. And by now I have to make up my characters, sadly, which is much harder.
Are you a people observer? Are you a sit on the bus and listen to people's conversations and build your characters?
God,
from
yeah, definitely, yeah, definitely. My neighbours had a stonking row at Christmas about something that happened at Whitsun and happens every year, and I'm literally waiting for the information. I'm hoping for a follow-up row. Like,
let's
what
say we got the next one in the diary.
I know. Yeah, exactly. I'm going to be here at Whitsun whenever that is.
Wow. I wonder who they were burying.
I know. Shot a burglar at Whitsun.
That's fine then.
So you said that before your sort of first published book came out, you'd written a couple that didn't sort of go anywhere. But have you had anything since that first publication that you could consider a fail? We're looking for failures in this podcast, as you might guess from the title. Or has it all been, since you got that first title out there, everything that you've touched has been gold? Or have there been some ideas that you've started and then just decided, you know what, that's not
I mean, I'm on quite a tight schedule, and I mean, I kind of fail every book because I always have a do-over, and the hook usually stays the same, but I've usually gone in at the completely wrong angle. So like the first draft of That Night was they killed a family friend, and when they were shoveling soil on his face, I was thinking, these are psychos, like, you can't do this. And what it was, I wanted to write a book about two families on holiday together, and one, there was an accident, and then it was kind of covering it up from the people you're on holiday with.
Right.
But it just didn't work. It was too, like, readers would have found it repulsive, I think. But I wrote the whole book. So Will in the book was an old family friend, and my characters were monsters.
Yeah, that's a very, very different book, isn't it?
Totally different. Yeah, totally different. So, yeah, so, but I did, between my fourth and fifth, I had an idea that I really wanted to write, which was about a woman who is sort of, her baby won't sleep, so she puts the baby in the back of the car, then goes back in the house to get her phone, and then another woman who is running away from something or late for something and needs a car and finds a car idling on the drive and drives it off and commits kidnap, basically. But so I actually got publisher approval from the US and the UK, and then when I came to actually sort it out and write a synopsis, I was just like, this book ends because any normal person would, as soon as they see a baby in the back, they would take the car back no matter what. And I could not find a reason. I was thinking, what if they find a gun in the car? And I was thinking, you'd still take the baby back and you'd tell the police about the gun. Yeah. Like, I just couldn't make it work. And then I listened to a podcast about witness protection and had the idea for How to Disappear, which is a family going into witness protection because their daughter sees a crime. And so I junked it. So I hadn't started, but I'd spent probably 6 weeks asking all of my family and friends in what circumstances they would steal a car. And, you know, what if there was a baby in the back?
Why are you asking?
Like,
yeah, no reason.
The baby?
I can just imagine like a big sort of Sunday lunch.
Yeah, that is
the third
typical week
in the row. Everyone's just sat around the table, just rolling their eyes going.
Yeah, I know.
Right, no, I wouldn't steal a car with a baby in.
I know, it's just, yeah.
And you're going, but, right, what if?
Yeah.
It's a really ugly baby. Is that what
I know, it was honestly scraping the barrel. I was like, okay, but what if, like, you thought that the parents were, like, you know, related to each other or blah, blah, blah. Like, it was just awful. So, so I junked that, and that was quite painful. But actually, weirdly, that...
I'd quite like to read that. Well, ridiculous scenarios involved.
I know.
That sounds great.
I know. I think it would have been a bit of a caper kind of...
Yeah.
But that baby in that car is a very small plot in my my time loop book. She has made an appearance as part of the organised crime group. They fuck it up, basically, and they're trying to steal cars, and then they steal a baby. And because they're in it's basically a drugs cartel, they do keep the baby. So it is a small part. It's like an incidental part of that book, which was nice to have my baby in the book.
Now I have an image of you going into the next family Sunday lunch going, ha-ha, there was a drugs cartel.
Yeah, exactly.
That was the answer.
Exactly. And they can be monsters, and that's fine.
Yeah, that's what they do.
Yeah.
It's funny, though. A lot of authors we've spoken to have said that, because we always try and get them to talk about the failures, but very rarely are there any, because everything that even gets trashed pops up in a few years' time to be used in a small way or a big way, or starts a new series or whatever, or gets picked up on. So nothing's wasted.
Yeah, and it's funny, like, if you were kind of learning how to, I don't know, make tables, you wouldn't regard your first table as, oh no, it's a total failure, like, I fucked it up. You'd be like, well, that's me learning how to do it. And I think that there is a lot of that in fiction, and because it's art and stuff, and nobody's paying you, I guess, most importantly, for those early books, you do shy away from, you know, having to junk stuff and not, you know, I've written two books that I didn't sell and will never sell. But I think it is actually all, it's very normal as part of anyone early in their career has things that are analogous to a failed novel.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that they're not useful in the future or they haven't provided a stepping stone or a building
block. They will teach you something. Yeah. I learned something from every one of my books that didn't sell, for sure. And my first book was a different genre, so actually if it had sold, I would have been writing in a completely different genre forever, maybe.
This is just a quick break to give you the chance to have a stretch. Shake it out, take a deep breath, and let's get back to the Failing Writers podcast.
Jillian, in your podcast, what goes on in your podcast?
So it's called the Honest Authors Podcast, and it's me and Holly Seddon. And, the bookseller said it's the only podcast where two traditionally published bestsellers talk honestly about life as a traditionally published bestselling author. So that's what we try and do. So we interview like publishers and editors, and you know, we had an editor talk to us about exactly what happens at an acquisitions meeting, which was really interesting. And we've interviewed our own agents and talk to them about sort of how they choose things off the slush pile and things like that. So yeah, it's kind of just a look behind the scenes, really, at author life.
And is that something that's ongoing? Is it going to be?
We've done 5 seasons. I think it's about 70,000 listens now. Wow. Yeah, so it's ongoing. We're starting again in September. We always have a break over the summer. We're kind of, last season we did sort of round table episodes. So we got authors gathered by type. So we had like authors who debuted in lockdown, for example, and we had authors who struggled with their mental health, like just a discussion. Yeah. We did prolific authors, which was really interesting. So authors who published more than one book a year, which it was really interesting because they all have exactly the same process. So it's still ongoing. So yeah, it's anywhere you listen to podcasts, just type Honest Authors.
I don't know about you chaps. Have you got any other questions to ask?
I've just got one more. What are you writing at the moment?
So I'm writing a book that I am calling Double Dealing. I'm not sure if that title will stay, probably not. And it's kind of a spin on a missing person case. And I really can't actually say much more than that because it is still so embryonic.
I see, okay.
But it's about a corrupt police officer and a missing person. But the missing person is most definitely not where you would expect them to be. And my whole book is built around this twist. And I'm still kind of trying to put the pieces together. I'm surrounded by bits of A4 paper with crazy things written on them as we speak.
And how far through that are you? Have you finished that first draft which you've binned, or are you,
have you deleted it?
No, I haven't even started the thing I'm gonna delete. Okay. Depressingly. So yeah, I've literally
so all those words are just gonna
I've gotta write, you know, 200,000 words to write 100,000 words soon. I'm gonna start, I think, maybe in a week or two. I literally just delivered my time loop book, and we've kind of been editing that. So it's time to start this one. I usually like to sort of start in the autumn.
Is that your favourite bit of the process, the initial first draft, like writing that idea out? Which bit do you like best, or is it finishing it?
I don't know if I'd really pull at that thread. I sort of like to have done it. I like my holiday. No, I do. My favourite bit is when I am really deep into it and it's really working, and it's just, I write lots of words a day or edit lots a day, and then I'm reading it before I send to my publisher and I think I've managed to do it again. That's usually my favourite part. So yeah, it lasts about a week. And the rest of the time is just trash. Self-doubt. Self-loathing, you know, staying up late, worrying about stuff, so.
And bribing yourself in between meals with the word count.
Yeah, exactly. Starving myself, you know, all very normal, non-dysfunctional behaviour.
Fantastic. Well, it's been lovely talking to you, Jilly. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, really nice. Thanks for having me on. I listened to your one with CJ Tudor and I said to my publicist, can I go on?
it's been great talking to you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for coming on.
Take care then.
Cheers.
All right, take care.
Bye, bye.
Well, there we go. It was interesting. We told you it would be, and it was.
Yep.
Can't argue with that.
We don't lie.
That is what a Richard and Judy book club person sounds like.
So, chaps.
Yes.
That was all very well and good, but, you know, straight away we need to be thinking about next week.
Oh, it's just never ending, isn't it? It's never ending.
Well.
I don't know what I'm going to do next week.
I might have done something.
Oh, not
in a
again.
Good way or a bad way.
I've done a little thing.
Get the mop and bucket.
And the thing is,
I've had an accident. John's done a whoopsie on the carpet.
I've set up an interview. Well, it's not an interview. I've set up a mystery guest.
Ooh. Whoa.
For next week. So someone, I'm not telling you whether they are male or female or what they do for a living. They're a writer, by the way.
Oh.
But they are going to be joining us, and you don't know who they are.
Sounds exciting, doesn't it?
I mean, that is what a mystery guest is.
Are we allowed any clues?
No,
Just
no.
Right, okay.
Nothing.
Do we know them?
You know of them.
So,
get ready for the mystery guest. And if you've got any comments about Gillian, if you're a fan of Gillian or you just want to say hello, send us a little tweet. Or an email.
Yeah.
You know where to send them by now, hopefully. But it's failingwriterspodcast@gmail.com or @failingwriters on Twitter.
Yeah.
Get in touch. It's nice to hear
give
from
us
you.
A shout.
And you can find links to her book and her podcast in our show notes.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're enjoying our podcast, do let people that you think would also enjoy the podcast know that you're enjoying the podcast. So they can enjoy it too.
Yes.
Screw it. Tell everyone.
Tell
you never
everybody
know.
About it.
You never
it.
Know. Just because Gran doesn't write books doesn't mean she won't enjoy the Failing Writers podcast.
Yeah, Gran. We're quite popular with Grans, I think.
Failing Writers podcast, number one for Grans.
I know a couple of Grans that have been enjoying
the show.
There
we go.
So, there you go.
So join us next week for a mystery guest.
Yeah.
Can't be more exciting than that. That is exciting.
It is exciting.
That is exciting.
Yeah. It is exciting.
All right, well, let's just say goodbye then, shall we?
Tatty bye.
Bye. Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Take care. Have fun.
See you then. Yeah.
Hello.
Where's everybody gone? Next week's episode is like that scene from Flash Gordon where the guy from Blue Peter sticks his hand into that thing to see if he'll get bitten by an horrible alien. And if you're not over 40 years old, you won't have a clue what that means.
To be fair, Betty, some of us are well over 40 and still have no idea what you're talking about. So.
Peter Duncan, Flash Gordon.
Oh yeah, rings a bell.